Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Guardian Mindset Podcast with the attorney Eric Daigle. I'm happy to bring you an episode today dealing specifically with the issues of public order and some very important recent court cases that have come out that are setting some concerns and also clarity for the aspect of protest response. Now, you all know that we have spent the last 5 years dealing with a lot of the protests that were a direct result of the death of George Floyd, and the response there, also plenty of political inspired public order response protests that led to some significant issues. Myself, I've been involved in a multitude of expert witness cases directly involved in crowd control and public order response. As I said, I'm here in Dallas, Texas, preparing to present tomorrow morning for the NTOA, National Tactical Officers Association Public Order Symposium, and also getting ready for the First Amendment Summit, which is the end of May 2025. And if you haven't checked out the First Amendment Summit, then we'd ask you to take a look at that at www.1asummit.com. And as always, these podcasts are sponsored by the DLG Learning Center, and all the aspects that we continue to focus on are directly involved in a lot of the training that we receive and provide across the country. Now, the reason why I'm bringing this podcast to light is because I'm preparing for this presentation, and I'm really getting deep into a case called Puente versus the City of Phoenix, which is a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case from the end of December 2024. And shout out to Adriana, who did some amazing research and prepared some of the court cases that I'll be dealing with over the next couple of days. But I really thought that this one was one that would get some interest in the application of crowd control and the importance of public order response. Because, you know, I got to be honest with you, if you look back, and a lot of us, we've dealt with First Amendment issues in dealing with, recording police, and also dealing with First Amendment auditors, social media, and a little bit of public order response or crowd control, but gives us an opportunity to jump into a little more detail, specifically using this case as a baseline for that. Now, when we deal with the issues surrounding public order, I got to be very honest with you. It's very legalese, and the issues that the courts are looking at are very focused into, very deep legal issues, such as First Amendment issues, Fourth Amendment issues, and 14th Amendment issues. Now, you know, the First Amendment issues are issues that we're just starting to get a good grip on, hopefully, and law enforcement is really focusing on the training, but that'd be, you know, issues such as First Amendment unlawful assembly, First Amendment retaliation, and we've done a bunch of podcasts on retaliation and freedom of speech. Hopefully, you've been up to speed with those. First Amendment standards for dispersing protesters and assemblies, and this is coming more to light with the significant amount of public order cases that we're starting to see throughout the court system. Fourth Amendment is one that we're pretty used to, because the Fourth Amendment is going to come under excessive force and the applications of excessive force. You know, the question is, what is a seizure under the Fourth Amendment? We'll take a second to get into that with this Puente case, and you'll see more details here. We also would have 14th Amendment cases, which is excessive force claims under the 14th Amendment, no seizure cases, under what we call the shocks the conscious standard. And I'll get into that a little bit with you. And then 14th Amendment intent to harm. Always in these cases, which I'm not going to get into today because we've done it so many more times, is that we really got to focus on the legal thresholds of qualified immunity and municipal liability standards. So qualified immunity, remember, you know, clearly established law. What's the guide that we have to maintain to keep ourselves, keep law enforcement officers protected by qualified immunity, is that they have to be well aware of, through training and application, of qualified immunity, of clearly established law, and also We have to be held accountable to the application of that when there is no consistency in dealing with this. You know, things that we're getting ready to discuss for the First Amendment Summit, like the recent settlement with the NYPD to Denver protest settlements to Portland protest settlements. But let's really just dive into this First Amendment application for a second and set the basis, right? What do we know about the First Amendment, unlawful assembly, a right to assemble and expression? We know the First Amendment guarantees the right to peaceful assembly and free expression, including public protest. The landmark cases back from the 1940s, Thornhill versus Alabama and Cantwell versus Connecticut, established limits on the government's ability to restrict, regulate, or punish public protest. The court made clear that the government must protect peaceful and truthful discussion on public matters, even if controversial or offensive, and cannot suppress free communication of views simply to maintain order. In 1940, in Cantwell versus Connecticut, it confirmed that maintaining public order is legitimate state interest, but does not justify silencing free communication of views. While it may be offensive, the speech did not threaten immediate bodily harm. Now, Thornhill versus Alabama, also in 1940, affirmed that open discussion about labor conditions in industrial disputes is vital for democracy, holding that no clear and present danger of destruction of life or property or breach of the peace was inherent to labor picketing, and thus the speech at issue deserved First Amendment protection. However, the First Amendment freedoms are not without limit. It does not protect violent protests, criminal acts, unlawful disruptions like blocking the roads, incitement to engage in violence, threats, or those who intentionally provoke violent responses. We know that we're going to look at very specific issues as we dive into this case. So let's start really with just using Puente versus City of Phoenix. Again, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case came out in December of 2024. Let's take a second here and just go into the facts, because the facts are very important here. Again, these are facts and most favorable to the plaintiff, because they are a summary judgment ruling. So just take that for what it is. On August 22nd, 2017, then President Trump held a scheduled rally at the Phoenix Convention Center. After the announcement of the rally, various organizations announced their intent to protest outside the event. These included the plaintiffs Potter in Action, they're also called Potter, and Puente, which are Phoenix-based membership organizations that engage in advocacy concerning immigrants' rights and other issues. In anticipation of the rally and accompanying counter-protest, the PPD, the Phoenix Police Department, coordinated with federal, state, and local agencies to develop a security plan. As part of the security plan, the PPD decided to designate two separate areas for security and protest assemble purposes. The first of those was called what we call a free speech zone on the block immediately north of the convention center where anti-Trump protesters were expected to gather. The second of these was called a public safety zone, which ran between the free speech zone and the convention center itself. In order to facilitate emergency vehicles and police access, the public safety zone, which included the street between the free speech zone and the convention center, was closed to the public and was fenced off from the free speech zone. Acting through its Community Relations Bureau, also known as the CRB, the PPD also communicated with local groups who had notified the PPD that they were planning demonstrations. These efforts included a meeting the day before the rally between a detective in the CRB and the protest organizers for Puente. Various protest organizers met with the members of the CRB to discuss their plans, arrange for delivery of supplies, and coordinate a police escort to the free speech zone on the day of President Trump's rally. The Phoenix Police Department, listen, they anticipated the possibility of isolated unlawful conduct occurring in the vicinity of the rally. Among the potential threats or weapons that the PPD might possibly be used were against them were improvised incendiary devices, guns, knives, rocks, human excrement. But based on its experience with prior protests, the PPD also had specific concerns about the decentralized movement known as Antifa, whose members the PPD believed might attend the event. The PPD was aware that Antifa members had engaged in violence or vandalism at previous public political events. Nonetheless, the PPD's planning for this specific event did not include any particularized rules of engagement concerning the use of force beyond those applicable to such deployment generally. Similarly, while the PPD anticipated that it might need to declare an unlawful assembly, it did not create a specific plan for doing so, and instead distributed general guidance regarding the unlawful assembly statute to its officers. The PPD's general training emphasized the tactic of isolating and addressing groups of individuals acting unlawfully within a larger protest. And it's important that we all pay attention to the fact that they are focusing on here what PPD did prior to the protest, what steps they took, what policies they reviewed, what training they did, and how they handled these situations. Now, PPD was also planned to have available at the event a contingent of persons from its tactical response units called TRU. This group, also known as the Field Force, is a specialized PPD unit that responds to civil disturbances. Its members are trained on and governed by specific PPD policies covering potential uses of force. This training includes guidance from protecting First Amendment assembly and free speech rights. Now, again, the important part that I think that we take a pause here to review is that, you know, what type of training have you done in your agency to focus on ensuring that the First Amendment rights are well established, that they're known, they're understood, and how your department can respond without violating those First Amendment applications. Go one step further within the TRU, within the Tactical Response Unit. They have a more specialized group of individuals called Grenadiers. Grenadiers train in the use of chemical agents and ammunition such as pepper balls, concentrated powdered chemical projectiles that induce a physical reaction similar to that caused by pepper spray. That training includes instructions on when and how to appropriately deploy chemical agents. Although Grenadiers are present at dozens of protests each year, and most recent prior to incidents were actually used chemical agent, they're going back to like July 2016, all named defendants were experienced Grenadiers who had overseen multiple protests prior to August 22nd, 2017. And moreover, the department as a whole had dealt with multiple protests along the way. So the pursuant to its security plan and to prevent protesters in the free speech zone from occupying the public safety zone in front of the convention center, the PPD erected a 3-foot-high pedestrian fence threaded with yellow police tape that said, "Police line, do not cross." In order to handle the crowds that they expected, they put in play approximately 985 public safety employees, including TRU officers, Grenadiers. They were deployed to the area. PPD also stationed undercover officers in the free speech zone to observe the demonstrators' activities and to monitor the crowd for possible threats throughout the afternoon and evening. So now it's time. Protesters began arriving outside the convention center on the morning of August 22nd. As we talked about before, some protest groups had notified the CRB in advance of their intention to protest, and then the CRB assisted them with logistical details, and that's something that we would expect to see in that open line of communication. The CRB assisted these groups with logistical details, including escorting some groups as they made their way to the convention center. Members of the plaintiff Puente and Potter arrived at the free speech zone shortly after 4 p.m. and demonstrated there for several hours. Approximately 6,000 people gathered outside the convention center at the height of the protest, which proceeded without major incidents during the day. President Trump arrived at the convention center around 6:30 p.m., and the demonstrators continued to remain largely peaceful. The first violent incident occurred shortly after 7 p.m., when unknown persons in the free speech zone began throwing water bottles across Monroe Street at the police and at those waiting in line to enter the convention center. The PPD responded by moving additional TRU officers to Monroe Street and by broadcasting a loud message using the long-range acoustical device, reminding protesters to stop throwing objects and to remain peaceful. Around that time, more received reports regarding the presence of potential Antifa members in the crowd, and he ordered his officers to watch them and to attempt to communicate with them. About an hour later, about 8 p.m., Moore received, this is the lieutenant who's in charge, received specific reports about certain of these potential Antifa members were carrying signs, including signs on tall poles. Now, what's the significance of that? Antifa members were known to have used these tall signs in the past to assist in toppling fences and barriers. And the PPD suspected that a similar attempt might be made to breach the fence separating the public safety zone from the free speech zone. At about 8:05 p.m., Moore was informed that approximately 10 to 20 individuals thought to be members of Antifa were beginning to start some trouble in the free speech zone. Given the group's distinctive clothing, banners, and behavior, Moore was able to identify several suspected Antifa members within the crowd in the free speech zone. And at approximately 8:07 p.m., he directed the head of the Grenadiers, Sergeant Douglas McBride, to get eyes on it. According to McBride, the Antifa members were acting aggressively and shouting profanities. Around the same time, officers observed suspected Antifa members shove a protester who had been told them to stop throwing objects. CRB officers approached these members and attempted to talk with them in an effort to de-escalate the situation, but the officers reported to Moore that the members would not communicate with them. McBride made all the Grenadiers aware of the suspected Antifa members in the crowd, but the PPD did not attempt to remove or arrest these people at this time. At 8:11 p.m., Moore was informed that President Trump's motorcade would soon depart from the convention center. At 8:15, Moore was informed that people were throwing water bottles down from a parking garage located at the edge of the free speech zone, requiring the deployment of the TRO officers to secure the building. The PPD used the LRAD to make continuous announcements to warn people not to throw objects. Around 8:20 p.m., Moore noticed that suspected Antifa members had erected large signs near the fence separating the free speech zone from the public safety zone on Monroe Street. The PPD officers approached and saw these members hooking their flags and banners to the fences. Moore believed that that would be a tactic to breach the fence. At about 8:30 p.m., Moore noticed that members gathering behind the signs and other members reported seeing them open bags and hand out unidentified items. The PPD officers did not attempt to separate these individuals from the crowd of protesters. Moore directed McBride to prepare the Grenadiers in the public safety zone to deploy pepper balls if the suspected Antifa members tried to breach the fence. Around 8:32 p.m., the suspected Antifa members began pushing the fence. Moore ordered officers to fire pepper balls at the ground in front of the suspected Antifa group. These pepper balls released pava powder, P-A-V-A, which temporarily irritates the eyes of persons nearby. As a result, some of the members of the group dispersed into the crowd of protesters. The PPD did not provide warnings or attempt to make arrests before firing the pepper balls. In a declaration, Moore explained that he made the decision not to attempt individualized arrest based on his belief that the suspected Antifa group members, quote, had not committed a crime or given cause for arrest, and that even if they had, sending officers into the crowd to conduct arrests would risk hand-to-hand violence, strain police manpower, and require opening the police fence. Some Antifa members remained, however. Another person who was not suspected Antifa member was standing near the fence, began shaking it with some force. The person was one of the plaintiffs. The Grenadiers then deployed more pepper balls in the area. Yellen was physically hit. One of the plaintiffs was physically hit by some of these pepper balls. With the suspected Antifa members then cleared the way from the police fence and dispersed among the crowd. Moore directed the Grenadiers to hold off from firing any more pepper balls to see whether the unlawful activity would stop. But the activity instead escalated, with individuals in the free speech zone throwing rocks, water bottles, and other objects at an increasing rate. This escalated in violence coincided with President Trump's motorcade leaving the convention center at about 8:33 p.m. At 8:34 p.m., an individual in the free speech zone threw a canister into the public safety zone that began emitting an unknown gas. Moore ordered the officers present to don gas masks and deploy smoke canisters. The smoke itself is inert and does not produce the same physical effects as tear gas. Although smoke was deployed in an effort to defuse the situation, create distance, and avoid escalating tactics, it did not succeed. Although some in the crowd left when the PPD deployed the smoke, many in the crowd continued to throw objects back at police. Indeed, the frequency of the items being thrown at officers significantly increased. The objects being thrown included pyrotechnical munitions of some kind, which burned for a few minutes before being extinguished by the police. Moore concluded that once these unknown devices were thrown at officers, the assembly had become unlawful. But he did not make any announcement to that effect. He instead ordered the Grenadiers to deploy tear gas, authorized the further use of pepper balls, as well as other riot-controlled devices. From approximately 8:35 p.m. to 8:45 p.m., PPD officers began dispersing the crowd in the sections of the free speech zone immediately across from the Phoenix Convention Center by using tear gas and flashbang grenades. At 8:39 p.m., Moore ordered the Grenadiers to cut the gap in the police fence, enter the free speech zone, and begin clearing the remaining individuals in the area using targeted munitions like pepper balls when necessary to drive back any threatening or aggressive individuals. He also organized a skirmish line of officers to walk slowly down Monroe Street from 3rd Street to 2nd Street, where there seemed to be a large number of unlawful actors. As the line of officers proceeded down Monroe Street, some members of the TRU deployed pepper spray from handheld canisters to a near specific individuals they perceived as threatening. At some point between 8:42 p.m. and 8:47 p.m., Moore decided to make a declaration that using the PPD helicopter public address system above the free speech zone, though the noise and chaos of the concurring police actions substantially diminished protesters' ability to understand and respond to the orders. At that, they continued then through with officers in a line and using the TRU officers formed a skirmish line and slowly marched along, cleaning the streets as it occurs. Now, the police chief, Chief Williams, stated in her view and the completion of the protest that the officers handled the crowd successfully and professionally, and all in all, that the event was a successful celebration. She later stated that the department's conduct was textbook perfect. And one of the things that was important was the allegations. Now, here's where things went a little bit sideways. You know, while she, as the police chief and the town manager, are hailing the officers' professionalism and ensuring the safety and First Amendment rights of the community, there was an independent investigation of PPD's conduct of the event, and the call for the investigation did not diminish the professionalism of the Phoenix officers. Here's the thing that drives me a little nuts. The officers, somebody produced a challenge coin commemorating the events of August 22nd, 2017. On one side of the coin depicted a protester being hit in the groin by ammunition, and the other side bore the inscription, "Good night, Left Nut." On the other side was the date of the protest surrounded by the inscription, "Making America Great Again, One Nut at a Time." And, you know, this is the stuff that causes my life aggravation. That's a great way to use it. Let's go with that, aggravation. Because what do you think they're going to use in the lawsuit, right? What do you think they're going to do when they deal with this issue? And where do you think we're going to see those challenge coins again, right? We know it's not I get, why are we doing this, right? So when we look at this case and the facts of this case, let's break down exactly what the issues were in the training objectives. So, you know, thank you for staying with me through all the facts, but this is where it gets important. The issues in training objectives of this case, which I think are a very viable case, are: did tear gas and other chemical munitions amount to a seizure, right? If no seizure, did the crowd control tactic shock the conscious? And we're going to get into this a little bit. And then the Fourth Amendment is the Fourth Amendment excessive force issues, which we'll get into in a second. But the First Amendment declaration of unlawful assembly and was declaring unlawful assembly and dispersing the protest an unlawful restriction on free speech. Right? There's going to be a lot of discussion in this case on excessive force. And the first one is going to be under the seizure context, you know, whether law enforcement's deployment of pepper and OC spray and the use of chemical and physical restraint as dispersal measures when not directed at a specific individual constitutes a seizure under Graham and under Torres. So the first thing that they're going to look at is the application of whether or not there is an excessive force seizure under the Fourth Amendment. And obviously, we're going to use Graham versus Connor. We're going to use the objectively reasonable standard. But the question here in the first part that we're going to get into is, was law enforcement's deployment of pepper and OC spray along with chemical and physical restraints, that would be, you know, the munitions that were used as a dispersal measure, when it was not directed to a specific individual, constitute a seizure? The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal came back and said, no, there's no Fourth Amendment seizure. The use of force arose, quote, outside the context of the seizure because the deployment of chemical irritants was not objectively aimed at restraining or confining protesters, but merely at dispersing them. And the court really gets into some very detailed application here. Now, remember, just before we get a little deeper into this, you got to remember that the lower court found in favor of the officers. And so now we're up on appeal and we're appealed to the Ninth Circuit. And the issues associated with that is what the court is going to uphold and to the benefit of the officers in this case. So what we do know is that the court applied in this case what we call the 14th Amendment shock to conscience test in order to focus on the decision of a seizure, right? The Ninth Circuit agreed that the use of airborne and auditory irritants did not constitute a seizure under the Fourth Amendment and that the 14th Amendment purpose to harm standard applied. The court found no evidence of an improper purpose to harm by the officers. Right? While the first argument was looking at the excessive force claim under the Fourth Amendment, the second was going to look at it under the 14th Amendment. And this is a no seizure context, right? So the first was a seizure context. That's what we're talking about. Whether the application of there was a seizure context, whether there was a seizure, it constituted a seizure under Graham and Torres. But there is two tests under the application of what the court calls shocks to conscience, depending on whether the officers had time to deliberate. All right, so let's talk about the what is shocks the conscious, and this gets very legalese, right? Shocks the conscious is a legal standard in the United States where an action is said to, quote, shock the conscious. Like it's something that was just so shocking to you. If it is grossly unjust to the observer, this means that the conduct must be arbitrary and egregious and that it shocks the conscience of the observer. The standard is used in judicial review, and relief can only be granted if the conduct meets the standard and is proven in court. And what we're saying is that the seeing it or hearing about it leads you to a 14th Amendment shock the conscious application. So in determining this, when we're looking at the two tests for shock to conscious, depending on whether the officers had time to deliberate. And so number one is the legal deliberate indifference standard. If the officers had time to deliberate, then the situation permits deliberation. The use of force shocks the conscious if the officers acted with deliberate indifference. And deliberate indifference, as we talked about, is the legal threshold that they did so knowing, having some knowledge of the outcome. And number two is the purpose to harm test, and that occurs when there is no time to deliberate. In snap judgment situations, use of force shocks the conscious only if officers acted with purpose to harm unrelated to legitimate law enforcement interests. Under the 14th Amendment use of force application, the no seizure, the question that was laid out is, if there is no seizure, did the crowd control tactics used by the PPD shock the conscious under County of Sacramento versus Lewis? The Ninth Circuit came back and applied the shocks the conscious standard. The court found no triable issue that the officers acted with an improper purpose to harm given the escalating security situation. They went into the freedom of assembly, unlawful dispersal. The question presented to the court in this case, whether conduct of persons in the free speech zone as a whole created objectively reasonable grounds to conclude that there was a clear and present danger of riot, disorder, interference with traffic upon public streets, etc. Right? In order to do a dispersal, there has to be clear and present danger. It would be, if there is not clear and present danger, there would be an unlawful dispersal. In this case, the Ninth Circuit came back and said, yes, there was a clear and present danger of immediate threat to public safety, and it was established to declare an unlawful assembly. Dispersal was justified, affirmed in favor of the officers. If you look at the facts, as we talked about them, the actions were already violent. Protesters tried to breach fences, separate public safety zones, causing PPD to repel they were through canisters with gas and pyrotechnical devices into the public safety zone. Retaliation. This is a very frequent case, frequent argument that we see now in First Amendment. We've talked about this over and over again. Failure to issue verbal dispersals. Was this a retaliation claim? Was the actions of the officers in retaliation for the comments and actions of the individuals? The court came back as to the retaliation claim. Ninth Circuit said there was no basis to claim that dispersing the crowd was motivated by retaliation. The PPD coordinated with protesters to keep things peaceful, only escalated when a clear, immediate danger arose. Of course, in this situation, they're going to talk about failure to issue verbal dispersal orders, because we know that the rules as it applies is to give a verbal dispersal orders. And the court came back and said that in this case, the lack of a verbal dispersal order did not violate the First Amendment because such an order isn't required when responding to an immediate threat during a non-peaceful protest, right? When this thing just turns sideways, then you just have to respond. these issues were also raised into supervisory and municipal liability. You know, did the employees, the chief, she, and other members of the command staff, did they act appropriately? And there was allegations of supervisory and municipal liability. The Ninth Circuit came back and the court affirmed the lower court's ruling on the summary judgment allegation, saying that the chief and the supervisors they concluded that the plaintiff's claim either failed or did not involve the violation of a clearly established right, and therefore claims of supervisory and municipal liability necessarily fail. So let's just summarize this application. The issues that we're taking away from this have to do with the applications of 4th, 1st, and 14th Amendment, right? We in this podcast, we talked about things that we don't talk about often, and that is shocks the conscience application and the concept of making the test evaluate situations that escalate so quickly that the officer has to make a snap judgment, finding that the officer's use of force shocks the conscience only if the officer acted with a purpose to harm the plaintiff for a reason unrelated to a legitimate law enforcement objective, right? So that would be retaliation. That would go hand in hand with the retaliation argument. What's our takeaways for this as we wrap this one up? For law enforcement, this case serves as a reminder that while managing large and potentially volatile crowds, officers must act with clear purpose rooted in public safety. They must maintain control over public demonstrations and understand that doing so is a complex task. But it is essential that officers balance the need to maintain order with the constitutional rights of those assembled by strictly following orders and acting in compliance with supervisory orders. As you see from this case, the things that are benefiting the planning stage, the training stage, the policy review stage, the methodical application of addressing the public safety issues is what came back in this case to support the officers in their actions and to uphold the qualified immunity arguments that were made at the lower level at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals level. And good case, clearly identifiable as to in the aspect of a training application, and one that I appreciate. Again, if you're into this type of stuff and you want to go a little bit further, strongly recommend you consider taking a look at our First Amendment Summit the end of May in Connecticut. Also, a virtual online application is there. And I thank you for spending your time with me for another edition of our Guardian Mindset podcast. And I'll end as I always do. Protect those who need your protection. Help those who need your help. And most importantly, keep yourself and others safe.